CliffCentral.com.
Yeah, good morning. Welcome to CliffCentral.com at just after 7 o'clock on Tuesday, the 22nd of June. And if you're listening to the podcast, it doesn't really matter what time of day it is because you're listening when you want to. That's what makes it cool. Sammy Lehoko is with us, as well as C.S. Angweni, and we are here to look after you for the next hour of the morning. You know, there's quite a lot of talk going on at the moment about people, this level three and how bad it is and how many people are getting sick. I just want to show you some things quickly to give you a bit of perspective because I needed this. I was starting to fall into the, you know, the trap of starting to believe that because I heard of a few people I knew who were sick, that it was suddenly much, much worse. And you know, that's happening. I mean, obviously you, and people only tell the stories of the ones who are very sick because who wants to hear a boring story about someone who is fine? And I've seen a lot of people who have been completely asymptomatic through the course of this coronavirus, but they've had it before. They've tested and they've had it. So here from Duncan McLeod, who's pretty good at this stuff, Duncan shows a graph here. He says the third wave is looking a lot less deadly than the first two. So here is the first one is the daily cases. So you can see the third wave is about equivalent to the first one at its peak, but it's nowhere near as high as the one in December last year. But here's the interesting one, the deaths. So this is according to Stats SA and all the latest information that we have. So you can see back in July of last year, that was the first wave. Then in December, January, that was the second wave. That's definitely a peak, but far, far fewer deaths here where we are now. So don't believe the hype. Although there are lots of people getting infected right now, very low death rate, which is good, and we want that. I don't know how anyone could hope for the opposite. I don't know how anyone's sitting there going, oh, I wish it was higher. But there are people who are genuinely afraid, and you should be careful, but you assess your own level of risk. So I just thought it was important to throw that in there because there's so much mad, crazy information going around, and people just, you know, they love drama. People love a bit of drama.
Yeah, I've been saying COVID is temporary, drip is forever. You can just say that mantra to yourself every day, you'll be fine. COVID is temporary, drip is forever. Yep, you know, right. So, yeah, you should say that.
Yeah.
You know, speaking of COVID, I mean, my grandfather actually picked up COVID in the hospital.
Ooh.
And that's how he passed away. So, you know, here you are, 90-something going in for something completely different.
Right.
You're there, we're getting updates, and everybody's saying, yeah, there's a bit of progress. But he was, of course, high risk. You know, he had the diabetes and the high blood and all that sort of thing. But constantly testing negative and boom, you know, one day just picked it up in the hospital. So, I mean, as much as you think you're going there to be cured, you might not even leave there alive. To be honest,
I'm not in a hurry to find myself in a doctor's room or a hospital if I can possibly help it. You know, not the greatest place to be.
I hate to take us further down this path, but there's a Daily Maverick piece that was released yesterday around this.
Mm-hmm.
And there was someone who was cited in the article who says, just take us in if you want to or not, saying, if the vaccine pace is not substantially increased, there will be a fourth wave of infections by December. And then they continue to say, there will be between 20 and 40 waves before we are all vaccinated. This is South Africa. Adding that at the current pace, it could take 10 years to completely inoculate South Africans. Well, you know what? Oh, well. I'm just done with this.
Who wrote that? Wrote that article? Because unless they've got
it was Daily Maverick.
No, but who's the author of the article?
I'll tell you who they cited. Fenter someone. If we're still going to go between 20 and 40 waves, then I'm just gonna right in my throat.
But this is also
that's gonna be the
this
case.
Is reality. I mean, we are going to have because you know viruses don't just disappear. They come back.
Yeah.
They come back in different forms. Flu hasn't gone away for thousands of years, and flu is not going to go away. Doesn't mean that you have to adjust your entire life, walk around with a stupid mask on forever, not touch other people, not go anywhere just because there's flu in the world. We have to be reasonable and realistic about this. This is not the end of human life on Earth. It's not like you need that vaccine if you're not a vulnerable person and you're not particularly upset. and you think you might have had it already, chances are you probably don't even need the vaccine if you're young and healthy. But there are people who do, and they must get it.
That's my concern. So they quoted Professor Francois Fenter, who's from Wits University. That's my concern. I know I'll be fine. And
now I think
if we're still going to go between 20 and 40 more of these things, then it's like, well, yeah, how are my grandparents going to be doing? How are my parents going to be doing? That's who I'm really concerned about. I just want to send them those old school tapes, and they better be practicing their New Zealand accent and their British accent. We're going to heighten it. Or all of a sudden, Zod was going to become Ethel, and Ethel's going to say, I don't know how I made it out of England, but I'm here for my jab.
Right.
She's from Harlem all of a sudden.
No, but what drives me crazy is like the people who are into, you know, they give you a constant update. I mean, if I go onto Facebook, which I try not to do much anymore because it's really dreary, but you have these people who are giving you like daily updates on their family and their family's battle against coronavirus. And I'm like, I don't need to know this shit. It's not interesting to me. You know, you've got people who are putting up their blood oximeter readings every morning, and you're like, come on. Do you really have – is that how self-absorbed and uninteresting your life is, that this is what you do every morning? You wake up and you give us your pulse oximeter reading. I mean, please don't. If you're doing that, just stop it.
When I went to get a COVID test a week or two ago, I mean, I was even told – you know, the thing that tells you whether it's negative or positive. I mean, the guy even said, take this as a souvenir. And I thought to myself, fuck, are you expecting me to post it and tag the company? And I got a certificate and everything. Do you want me to frame this thing? Exactly. Do you want me to post and tag you? I mean, it's bizarre. It's absolutely bizarre. So we're even being told, like, take this, carry it with you, treasure your results.
I know someone I know someone who has been, let me just see if I can, I don't know why this camera is moving now.
See, being a YouTuber is very difficult, Gareth. Look at us now.
This is really
look
difficult.
Look at us.
Jesus. I'm getting this right. What is happening? So I know someone who has gone for, she's been for five of those tests, and she's just desperate to find out she's got coronavirus. There's no other way to put it. She's not going because she's worried she's got it or she's had it. She's almost willing herself to get it because she feels left out. What, isn't that stupid? I mean, that's stupid. That person should be put in a psychiatric ward. Honestly, if you're going to go back for your fifth or sixth test and you're so desperate to get coronavirus, then let someone cough on you at the shops. Seriously, it's pathetic. So I want to go to some emails quickly because we've got some really nice emails here. This is from Mashoba Paddy Mazibuko, who says, first off, Gareth, I want to say I'm a daily listener. I never miss your show. I send messages on WhatsApp, but tonight I thought I'd email you. I'm listening to the last few minutes of your interview with Mac G, and wow, I followed you and your team since the we haven't even referred to that, but it was released last Thursday, and it was apparently it was quite a big deal. I mean, it got lots and lots of views and downloads, and I'm thrilled because I like Mac G, and I think he's a brave guy, and I like the kind of material he's producing at the moment. Anyway, so we did that show last week, and Paddy's saying here, followed you and your team since the 5FM days. Just want to quickly refer to something you mentioned in the interview. I only wanted to say what a dope interview, and even though I've listened to you for years, that interview was really refreshing, and I respect you guys and the things you do even more than I already do, which is tons. Not saying it's worth much, but I was inspired. I learned a bit about you, even though I was convinced I knew all that you had to offer. Although I started following Mac G's podcast after you mentioned him on your show and interviewed him on So What Now. Thanks for that, too. I have two South African podcasts that I follow religiously now. Isn't that nice?
That's very cool.
Mashoba Mazibuko. Very nice of you to send us that email. And then this is another nice one. I'm hoping to get some horrible ones too, so I can balance it out. But it seems the people who send the horrible ones have stopped listening to us. Mervin and Jenny, who are 82 and 70 years old, sent this to me, which is quite sweet. While traveling on Friday morning from Knysna to Port Elizabeth, my husband and I were entertained by your show that was hosted by Sia in Gareth's absence. We thought that he did a great job. There we go, Sia. Compliments for you. And upheld the standard of your show. Nice, Sia. We enjoyed the conversation between Sia Leanne and Michael on the subject of crying and whether Sia actually sheds a tear or two. It had us laughing, or was it crying? Ugh. By the way, most nights we listen to the podcast of that morning's show. I turn to my husband and say to him, what would you like to listen to? And he always replies, that Cliff chap. Too soon, I hear gentle snoring at my sister. So this old man, he says he wants to listen to us, and then he falls asleep listening to us. Thanks very much. Thanks, Mervyn. Great. Anyway.
Is it a compliment, perhaps, that we're so soothing we lull him to sleep, or perhaps we just bore him right out?
Mervyn and Jenny say they started listening during the first lockdown, and you really helped keep life real for us. Well, that's awesome. I love the fact that we've got someone who's 82 who listens to us, and we've got someone who's 16 who listens to us, and everything in between. It's very nice. You see how much we have evolved, Sammy, since you were last on the show.
Yeah, I'm quite impressed, but I expected nothing less, trust me. And this is the thing about also, we're so focused on the negative, you know, all that's happened since COVID and the lockdown and whatever. But to be very honest, there's been so much opportunity to expand and be innovative and to do things online and just be creative, you know, if anything. I mean, I would expect people to have been coming with more and more new ideas.
Are you doing some fun stuff? Because I know you've got a huge following of people who love what you do. And when you were on TV and radio, you always made people laugh and smile and think and cry and all kinds of cool stuff. Are you back in that swing of things yet, or are you giving yourself a little bit more runway?
Yeah, so remember I was doing this whole soul-searching thing, and, you know, I realized that radio will always be something that I'm very, very passionate about. I've loved it, you know. Mm-hmm. Don't think as much as you know, I don't really enjoy TV as much anymore. But what I've been doing now is trying to have quite a nice balanced life. You know, I gym quite a lot. I'm working in the family business, which is very interesting. I've got a sponsor, you know, Five Pillars. I do these online meetings, etc.
Nice.
But I'm also studying and doing something with the Life Coach Academy. So hopefully by the end of the year, I would have graduated and I can open a wonderful practice, and I'm looking for some clients. Hello. But the other thing that I started doing, like I mentioned before, is volunteering at a secondary school in Cosmos City.
Yeah, that sounds really interesting. Now, these are kids. Obviously, Cosmos City is a pretty poor neighborhood. It's a township, but it's mostly shacks because – you know, the people who live there are trying to live close to where they work, and they're just living in whatever kind of dwellings they can get. There are some informal houses there, but it's really not a great neighborhood. And I would imagine life is very hard for people who live there.
Look, I think the approach that many of these teachers take, remember, they've had enough, they're inundated, they just want to get through the year. The approach is constantly to these kids. You know, why do you behave like this? What is going on with you? Why do you have such an attitude? And the approach should actually be, what happened to you? So that's where I come in, and that's my question. What happened to you? It's not so much about you. It's about the environment, the circumstance, your family. Yeah. And I didn't go in there as a life coach. I didn't go in there as an expert. I went in there to be some sort of outlet. And my first sort of task for my students, 28 of them, was write me a letter. Say, Miss Lehoko, this is what is going on for me. And Gareth, I kid you not, some of the stories that came out.
You remind me of Michelle. Bizarre. You remind me of Michelle Pfeiffer in that movie where she went.
Yes.
What was it?
Is it about?
And they had Coolio's.
I have the theme song in my head.
Spending most our lives living in the gangster's paradise.
Was it called? Was it about debating or poetry?
No. It was a school in like a New York neighborhood, like Washington Heights or North Harlem or whatever. And she was the teacher. And then she went in
Dangerous
there.
Dangerous Minds.
Dangerous Minds. Dangerous Minds.
Yes.
That's what you're doing, Sam.
Mr. Fullian said so. So listen, we're living in a world where we're not going back and really understanding, you know, what happened, you know. So I do find this process really fulfilling. I find it, you know, fun at times, but it's also really sad. I mean, I'm sitting and thinking, look, I come from a very political background. You know, my father was passionate about education. My father dragged my mom to the UK to study in Manchester. And now it all comes out, you know, that I too am passionate. I have this ardent way of engaging with young people.
Tell us a little bit about your family background. I don't actually know the story, so this is going to be news to me and probably to a lot of us. Tell us about your family.
Okay, so my mum and my dad, like I said, you know, worked in politics for many years. My dad was in the forefront of COSATU, also a teacher. Mm-hmm. Worked in the Department of Education. Mum worked in the presidency, also in Parliament. And I think that with everything that was going down, just the bullshit, they said, no, we can't do this and we can't be a part of it. And I think for the longest time, as much as I should have had some sort of interest in politics and the history of my country, I just absolutely didn't, you know. And I was so different from all my brothers, you know, both my parents, in fact, you know. And when my dad passed away, the penny dropped for me. The penny dropped and I needed to live this legacy. I needed to continue the story that my father had started writing, you know. Yeah. So I think what we forget is that it is about young people. I think that we need to encourage young people to be a part of change and transformation, you know. Or then sometimes I wake up and I think, fuck, I think we should just wipe this middle generation out and fucking start from scratch.
Hey, you can't talk genocidally like that. You sound
what
like
a reset button. Fuck. But, you know, it is
just because we like Katy Perry music and we want to be on TikTok and we like.
You're talking about Sears.
It proves that I'm not young anymore because I don't know what young people are.
Right. Like. Careful. These are Sears
That's
people.
That's it, Haley.
No,
that's it. But you know, I've really been enlightened by just this journey that I've started walking. And maybe I should refer back to Kenan's point earlier. You know, but the same old druggy story, me. You know, that's what it was. You know, but now it can't be me. You know, it has to be about. And sometimes it's not even really about people. It's just about being present. You know, understanding. This whole concept of connection, you know, human connection, connecting with people, because, you know, I like to preach this whole thing, the opposite of addiction is connection, you know, and for the longest time, that's what we haven't been doing. We're not connecting on an emotional level.
I
in one of my lectures, I did this thing called a life wheel, CNG, you should try it out. It's just literally a wheel.
What is that?
Divided into different segments. Right?
Yeah.
It's divided into different segments, you know, business, career, studies, recreation and fun, finance and wealth, you know, all sorts of things, spirituality. And you literally on this life wheel make a dot as to where you are in that, you know, sort of facet of your life. And then you obviously connect the dots afterwards. The whole idea is to balance your life, to see what's, you know, areas of your life you've been neglecting versus what you've been giving too much time to. So maybe I'm not as spiritual as I should be, and I'm paying more attention to, you know, fun and games. That's what I was fucking doing for all my life. But the point is, when it comes to love and romance, it's not just about being in a relationship and, you know, having a one-night stand and feeling loved. It's about, am I willing to receive?
Hold on, you're about to upset Sia again. He thinks life is about one-night stands and landing some kind of rich person. That's all Sia wants, is a rich man.
Girl, you better call me the King of August because I am riding those bicycles.
Where do you find them? These rich old men. Come on.
Yeah. Do you think I love the Wednesday fish and chip special at the country club? No. I'm there to scout. No.
Sia wants more.
Honestly speaking, I mean, it really is about, am I open to accepting love from the world and the universe? And am I also willing to give love to the universe? You know, and I mean, I don't want to get too deep into this whole thing, but it's just incredible how much I've actually been missing out on. How I've just been missing out on on beautiful friendships, on experiences.
Family, you've learned a lot.
You've gone deep.
I have.
You've gone deep. Okay, let me ask you this question.
Should I also write a book? What do you think? Yeah. Should I also
write a book? Yeah, do it. It's easy. Here's something I want your opinion on. All right, so you know Victoria's Secret have decided that Victoria's Secret make the world's best lingerie, and for a long time, whenever any man has gone overseas, he has had to stop at Victoria's Secret with all kinds of measurements written on a card, and he's had to buy his girlfriend, wife, or both a set of the sexiest lingerie that he could find. And Victoria's Secret always used to be this extremely sexy brand. You know, they had beautiful, beautiful women like old Candace Swanepoel, who comes from South Africa, who would flaunt their wares down the ramp wearing angel wings. It was a whole thing. I mean, you know what I'm talking about, Sammy. Victoria's Secret is a worldwide phenomenon, and everybody loved it, right? Now, look at this. Here's an ad of what Victoria's Secret are now doing. And ignore the head of Megan Rapinoe sticking in the side. That's obviously photoshopped in, but the rest of it is totally real. This is what Victoria's Secret want you. This is how they sell panties and bras now. Okay, you ready? Look at this. There we go. So that is, and the reason that Megan Rapinoe, the soccer player's head, is sticking in the side with the purple hair is because she has been recruited as an ambassador for Victoria's Secret. Now, these women in this picture are all to someone beautiful, okay? And beauty is totally subjective. Yeah. So there are a lot of people in the world who find a lot of other different people very attractive for different reasons. We don't have a universal standard of beauty. But I must tell you, honestly, that this is not going to make me want to go and buy a girl one of these bras, panties, sports bras, these I don't know what you'd call what one or two of them have on there, like a Hessian sack that they've spread around their formidable asses. But I this is not the kind of advert that I think is going to do Victoria's Secret any good. I know what they're trying to do. They're trying to seem woke, trying to seem like they're all-inclusive. But the reason it was sexy is because they used to have these extremely sexy girls doing the ads. In my opinion, sexy. And clearly they sold to a lot of other people based on that. This is not the same. Yep. What do you think of this? Am I being extremely backward and old school and stupid and insensitive and dumb? Or is there something to it? What do you make of that?
Look, I mean, when you put that up on there, gee, I wouldn't have said that it's Victoria's Secret. I mean, when you think Victoria's Secret, you think tall, slender, skinny women, sexy lingerie. I mean, I'm not the target market. Firstly, I'm not fucking tall at all, you know.
Sure.
But I don't know. It's tricky. It's really tricky because, yes, you want to be this all-inclusive thing, but at the same time, that's not what it is. There's other brands for that, you know?
That's my point. Not everything has to be all-inclusive. Sia, what do you think?
No.
So Victoria's Secret went way too far left in trying to redeem their image. They, firstly, even before this, Victoria's Secret has been overtaken by other brands because they just are not speaking to the times anymore. For a very long time, Victoria's Secret was the industry leader because there was not a lot of competition. Look, I used to even watch the shows. I love the shows. They were sexy and there was music and there was, you wanted to see that expensive bra and how many records it would break that year. But now more and more brands are coming to play and they're speaking to different people. What they have wrong with this, so they've now called this new campaign the VS Collective. Okay. And they've put together different people, this Megan Rapinoe, Priyanka Chopra, to represent everyday women. The simple principle of marketing and advertising in general is you have to be aspirational. Do I want to aspire to be like someone who looks like the girl next door? No. And I think size is the last of their worries because someone who gets it right is Rihanna. She has a line called Fenty. Mm-hmm. It's all lingerie. And so contrast Victoria's Secret to Rihanna. Yeah. It's still slightly plumper girls, but that is sexy. It's girls who have makeup on. It's girls who have their hair done. You see there's something aspirational to it. So I think the days of Victoria's Secret, sadly, are over. They just are letting competition win.
These war elephants over here are going to trample that fucking brand to death.
It just looks like it looks so half-assed. But I do have to say a very big thank you to Victoria's Secret for helping me get through school when I was attracted to Tyra Banks and like the fabulousness of Tyra Banks, but then I go to an all-boys school and then they think I was cool. Meanwhile, I'm like, I don't care about the girls. I just care about how fabulous the show was.
So Victoria's Secret was like your cover story.
Yes. Okay. No, but really, like, it's fabulous. I wanted to know about the models, Salita E. Banks, Alessandra, Naomi Campbell. I was interested in their lives.
You knew all that stuff.
And then you go to an old boys school, you talk about Victoria's Secret, they're like, yeah, she's so hot, right?
Right.
Like, sure, okay.
All right.
Rest in peace, Victoria's Secret. Shame.
Well, I thought we needed to see that this morning. We've got to get to blind history, but Sammy, it's been really cool to catch up with you again, and I'm delighted that you are on the warpath and you've got stuff going on and you're helping out these kids in Cosmo City, and I think you should write a book, frankly. It sounds like you've got a lot to say, and a lot of it might be the kind of stuff that many people need to hear. So I'd get onto that if I were you. And it's almost like journaling is now it's become a way for people to enter the world of writing books. And once you've written down your own thoughts and ideas, then you put it together into something else. And before you know it, it is a book. I think you should do it.
No, Solon Sam.
Century and Frank, y'all.
Yeah.
Okay, let's not take it that far.
I don't know if you want to be Anne Frank, but I hear you. I hear you. Start off with your secret diary.
But, I mean, look, at the end of the day, I really didn't know what I was going to say on the show. And I really do think that it is important to share my story and my journey. You know, you never know what could come out of this. There's people who are doing the exact same thing, going through the exact same struggles. And this is what I've learned, is that there are people who can relate. Look, I saw in the comments, somebody had said that they want a real current druggie on the show. I don't know how that might, end.
Listen,
I'm not reformed either. Pay no
attention.
But
this audience of ours will give every one of us shit anytime they can. They don't take any prisoners. That's why I love them. They always give us the honest feedback. But look at these. Speak about honest feedback. Look at some of these comments about Victoria is no more a secret. That's from Silas. Erica says, by the way, Megan Rapinoe has been cancelled due to racist Asian tweets. Oh, surprise, surprise.
Yeah.
Tando Kuchler says, they could have put those same ladies in way better underwear. I agree, but there's only so much that, the what do they call it? The load capacity can take. Harmin says, what if one of those girls gets a heart attack on the runway, huh? Good point. Kidwell says, I just think they want to appeal to a broader market. That's possibly true. I think that's absolutely right. But what Sia was saying about aspirational values is important too. Jenny says, this is an insult to all those who put in the time showing us how many calories they burnt on their workouts. Eleutheria says, Victoria's Secret should have stuck to their lane. Apparently, Victoria's Secret very involved with Jeffrey Epstein. Ooh, okay, I didn't know about that. Yes. And then Miss Yeye says, I think it's clever, probably going to have a spike in sales since there are a lot more ugly women than pretty women in the world. So basically, Miss Yeye is saying those are very ugly women.
Everyone wants to be pretty. So
Mandy says it's absolutely fabulous. It doesn't mean every ad they have to do is inclusive, but this is so cool. All right. You see, the people like Megan like that. There's nothing wrong with that. Lots of different comments here. Is the one on the left a guy? On the very left. Let me just look at it again.
Gary.
Let me just see. Hang on. The one on the very far left.
My left or your left?
Oh, that would be Megan Rapinoe.
Wow. Yeah.
Oh, that one. Yeah, yeah.
No. I think the red-haired one.
The ginger.
Oh, right. I got you. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. The short ginger hair. That's a, yeah.
Can we still say ginger? Is that politically correct?
Yes. Who knows these sure days? It is. Of course it is. What else are you going to call people with ginger hair?
Red-haired.
Yeah. All right. Very, very
the
good.
The one with the red hue.
That's enough of us being sizist this morning, or whatever you want to call us, because, you know, something like that's going to come up. But Sammy, it's always good to see you. Thank you so much, darling, and have a lovely day and an excellent week, and we will check in with you soon.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. Thanks to all the listeners for keeping it cool, and you guys are doing great. It's been such an honor. Best start to my day ever. I'll see you soon.
Love you too. Thank you.
After the early wake-up call.
Yeah.
I can't even go back to bed now. So.
Yeah. No. No one likes to wake up at 5:30 in the morning. All right. Thanks very much. Nice to see you. Thanks, Sammy.
See ya.
That brings us to Blind History, which today is all about one of the most powerful men in France, a man called Cardinal Richelieu, and he was the architect of absolute monarchy. He was a guy who had a strategic mind and a dedication to French interest above all, and made it possible for Louis XIV a little later and for Napoleon much later to make France the envy of the world. And we're going to take you back to the early 1600s into the mind and the personality of this incredible man, Cardinal Richelieu. And this is a special episode of Blind History. It's almost the last in our fifth season, this episode on Cardinal Richelieu, and we have more for you in the pipeline. We've been busy talking to Anthony and Kate and everybody else at Taylor Blinds and Shutters, and it looks like there may be a sixth season, but don't take it from me yet. I'll confirm that once we know for sure. Here it is in the meantime. Blind History. If you ever get the chance to walk down the open Galerie d'Orléans in the Palais Royal, you may be able to imagine the imposing figure of the Red Eminence. His swirling cardinal's robes billowing behind him as his buckled shoes clatter on the marble floors. On his way to attend some great matter of state in service to his king and to France. Cardinal Richelieu, the arch-strategist, was always busy with matters of state. And his influence has bled into Europe, along with the blood of the wars he started, the idea of the modern nation-state, and his network of spies. A note for this episode, there may be some annoying French pronunciations by me. I'm going to do my best to get them right. But since Cardinal Armand Jean de Richelieu was the founder of the Académie Française, I'm going to do my best to at least honor him by pronouncing things where I can correctly.
And I'll abstain from
Blind History. We're on to an episode about somebody who I've always thought was fascinating, and was a suggestion from one of our listeners that we cover Cardinal Richelieu, who was the first minister of France under King Louis XIII. Not much to look at, but he had that famous little beard and the little moustache, little goatee, the flowing hair under the cardinal's cap, and always in red. Famously, he is depicted, and most people may only know him from The Three Musketeers by Alexandre Dumas, where he's the villain, he's the bad guy, he's the manipulator, the arch-propagandist of that time, and the musketeers have to fight him in order to do their king a great service. Of course, the reality is that the king was hugely dependent on Richelieu.
I think that was probably a good summary of...
Do you think so? Should we Richelieu. Stop there?
Yeah.
Okay, well, then we can just stop there. So anyway, he was born a fairly ordinary chap. His father died when he was quite young. His mother needed one of her sons to go into the clergy because there was a bishopric available nearby. And his brother said, hell no, I actually am a believer. I'm going to become a real priest. And so Armand Jean said, pas de problème, I will go and be the bishop. He was elected. He was very young. He had to actually go to Rome and have a papal dispensation issued so that he could become the bishop of that particular town. And before he knew it, he was in public service.
So he was born in Paris.
Yes.
But he'd gone to Paris, obviously, for schooling. And schooling in those days, there was a lot more about being a courtier and learning skills, learning how to fight, but also learning how to act in the royal court.
There is no doubt 100%. This guy was very clever. from an early age, he had a very good brain and a quick wit and an ability to get people to do what he wanted.
Yeah. It could have gone both ways, but like you said, his brother decided to become a monk. Mm-hmm. And so he had to take up this position on behalf of the family. But he did an incredible job. If you look at Catholicism at the time, they needed to, if the right word is to freshen up, to take on the Protestant angle that was
absolutely
happening.
Especially in France with the Huguenots, who'd become a very powerful lobby.
Yes, and strong politically, yeah.
And remember, the clergy were hugely involved in politics. It's not as if they stuck to religion and the nobles stuck to politics. It was a mixed bag. And the Etat General, which was eventually the cause of the French Revolution, the breakdown between these different estates, part of the reason is that the lines were so blurred. Yeah. At that point. So he saw it as an opportunity also to advance himself and his family.
Correct. And I think he put things through, like the clergy weren't going to pay taxes.
Yes.
And trying to put a lot more onto the poor commoners.
Mm-hmm.
He was so clear in what he wanted to achieve. He needed to put France back on top, mm-hmm. get rid of the interbred Habsburgs.
Yep. He didn't like the Spanish and the Austrians, which were the Habsburgs.
And then he wanted to get rid of the weakened king scenario. And
the nobles had far too much control at that stage. And so we've got to start the story by just outlining who the kings of France at this time were. And I even drew a very simple family tree just so I could figure out who's who here. So Henri IV was murdered, but he was married to Marie de Medici, who was apparently very stupid.
She was.
And quite large.
She was large, stupid, but ambitious.
But ambitious and not a bad strategist.
Yeah.
Just shows you don't have to be super clever like Richelieu to be a good strategist. Marie de Medici got everything she wanted all the time.
Yeah.
And she eventually was so irritating to her son, Louis XIII, who was the next king after Henri IV, that he eventually locked her away.
Correct. He got rid of her. Yeah.
But she was the woman who opened the gates to Richelieu to become the courtier and the minister that he became.
When he became bishop of his home area where he grew up, mm-hmm. they voted him to go and talk in front of the royal court. And he obviously was just charismatic and he said all the right things. And Maria de Medici just thought, this guy's incredible. We've got to bring him in. And I think at the time, they always had somebody in government that was looking after their interests. And I think she did as well.
Yeah, and he was the right guy to do this because he was an efficient administrator, a cunning strategist, and someone who understood how to raise certain people up and suppress others. I mean, he did lower the power of the nobility to a degree where the king had the kind of power that he could effectively make decisions and the right. nobles had to carry it out.
So absolute monarch.
And that set the path up for Louis XIV eventually.
But also what he did was he picked Louis XIII's friends, or you would call it.
Yeah, his whole court.
His whole court.
He decided who to surround the king.
Yeah.
This king must have been a bit dim.
I think he really relied on him, but what was clever about him, he said, look, I must keep this guy around.
Yeah.
So when his mom started talking cuck, he needed to exile her. Yeah. He got every now and then he lost the plot and he did say it's the end of the road. I think it was really only once. It's the end of the road. And I think it lasted 24 hours and the king ran to Richelieu and said, please come back. I'll get rid of my mom. Just come back. So that's one thing that Louis XIII understood. He really needed Richelieu. And if we look at who the king was of France at the time, it was Richelieu.
Yes, without a doubt. I mean, there's that you refer to the Day of the Dupes, which is basically where he had his lowest influence. The enemies of Richelieu had started to believe that they had succeeded in persuading the king that he was no good. But as you say, it lasted a few days, a few hours, and then he was reinstated as first minister. He needed him more than he needed the enemies.
Correct. How the nobles got their strength in that they always had their own armies and they could mobilize it or they could get together. So what he did was he destroyed all their castles, just not the ones on the borders to protect against the inbreeders, but definitely in the other castles. And so they had no strength.
Let's just mention here as a note to this that Anthony's not being unkind. The Habsburgs at this stage were the dynasty of the Holy Roman Empire, which was in Austria and in Spain. There were two arms of the family. They might have had three arms the way that they were intermarried, but they were so inbred, it's not unfair to say this, that some of these kings had chins that stuck out further than their noses. Some of them had cleft palates and ears on the back of their head, and not great.
If you just look at pictures of the Habsburg, the chin basically goes down to the belly button. They had to be helped to eat, and you're right, the ears were properly unbalanced. There's not even, you're not stretching the truth.
So his one problem was with the nobles, and as you've pointed out, he managed to destroy their authority over the king and concentrate the authority of the king, centralize the government. But he also took out the Huguenots. He was publicly very opposed to them as a strict Catholic and later as a cardinal, which is as a prince of the church. And they called him the Red Eminence because you address a cardinal as your eminence, and he used to wear red. Cardinals do that. And in France, he was on top of the pile. He was the most important man in France. But as much as he disliked Huguenots, he wasn't averse to making alliances with Protestant countries where he wanted to and needed to. So he issued some, I don't know if it's 100 or 170 treaties during his time as first minister. And sometimes multiple treaties with the same country. Holland, the Low Countries as they were called, England. He made deals with Piedmont and Switzerland, which at that stage was like an independent canton of France. And the guy was happy to make, he was pragmatic. He was happy to make a deal with anyone who'd make a deal with him to achieve his ends.
For the good of France, he would make alliances to take out the Spanish Catholics in northern Italy, which was a strategic place where they felt France could be under pressure. So he wasn't afraid to make alliances, as you said.
And for the Huguenots, obviously, as sad as it was, persecuted as they were, many died. Some fled, and his surname was Duplessis, and there are many Duplessis in South Africa.
Correct.
As a result of them having been Huguenots and having fled in the wake of policies brought to bear by Cardinal Richelieu.
But what was quite interesting as well was the leniency in terms of he allowed the Protestants to be able to practice their faith, even after he basically took them out. But he decimated the political strength. You know, they were no longer a force in France. After there was a war that happened, the religious war, I think it was in La Rochelle. Mm-hmm. I think it lasted a year. And after that, the Huguenots as such, you know, they had no more power.
Yeah, that siege at La Rochelle is a famous result of the war between the forces of Louis XIII and the Huguenots.
Correct. And he was in the front in that war.
Yeah, he commanded, I think, the troops of Louis XIII. So He was obviously a figure of some intrigue, a very grand personality. He was obviously extremely talented at winning over the people who he could whisper things into the ears of. But he had a spy network, and he's also credited with being the inventor of the modern secret service, the modern secret agency, which is interesting. He had a huge network of spies across all of Europe who filled him in on everything, and he was constantly at work. He was always at his desk writing letters, developing treaties, giving missives, sentencing people to death, and he had plenty of enemies.
But I mean, people were so naive around him. I mean, even the king's brother. I mean, they came up with these plans. They're going to take him out. I mean, he knew about it.
Yeah.
It's incredible. That spy network really worked well.
It was superb. And he was also grooming his successor, Cardinal Mazarin, who would end up taking over after him and who would play an important role in bringing Louis XIV to power after Louis XIII's death. And he was also a press censor. You know, he shut down the press because if they didn't say what he wanted them to say, too bad for them.
Mm.
There was no freedom of speech or expression under him. He also banned all political discussion outside of the Parlement. So if you spoke about politics in public and he overheard you or one of his spies overheard you, off to jail. No politics for you. But he's also known as the father of the modern nation state because of his administration and the bureaucracy he developed around him. He was probably the best early example of how the nation state would develop after that. And his memoirs are, I think, the raison d'état, the reason for the state, the purpose of the state. And he's supposedly the guy who coined the sentence, the pen is mightier than the sword.
Correct, he did do that. That was one of his famous statements. But overall, I think if you look at all the countries around, even Charles I, who was a tyrant in England, he had the Duke of Buckingham, who was absolutely useless as a soldier. And Richelieu was key in destroying him.
Well, so, the Duke of Buckingham was actually Charles I's father, James I's lover.
Oh, that's true, correct.
So that was something people didn't talk about too much in the history books, but it must have been all the gossip around town in London.
Yeah. But maybe you're skilled in other areas and maybe not as a soldier.
Perhaps, yeah. But what is interesting about Charles I is that that marriage was also orchestrated by Richelieu.
Correct.
He made sure that Henrietta Maria of France married Charles I.
Yes, Mary. In England, they called her Mary, but it was
and
Maria.
And then when he had his head cut off, Charles I, his son, Charles II, came to live at the French court and then returned to assume the throne back in England and put England back on course.
So he was just the chess master, just moving the pieces around the board.
Without a doubt. And I think if we look at French history all the way up to probably the end of the Napoleonic era, you can sense Richelieu's influence through all of it.
Yeah,
he was a patron of the arts. It's worth saying that he was a tremendously aesthetically aware human being. I mean, he commissioned incredible work on his Palais Cardinal, which became the Palais Royal in France. It's now the seat of one of the chambers of the French legislature. And he commissioned a number of explorers. Saint-Simon, I think, was one of the most famous ones, to go up into the Saint-Laurent Strait and up the Saint-Laurent River, and they founded French Canada.
Yeah,
and it's called New France at that stage.
And I think that there's even a city that's named after him in Canada. There's so many different things that are named after him in his legacy.
Even a brandy here in Saint-Laurent.
I think Richelieu.
Yeah, it's a good
egg. Yeah, I think with the Coke. Okay. I'm not sure, you know, how deep it goes, but France at the top of the pile. I think that was his number one priority. By the time he passed away, France was on top of the pile, and the king was everything.
So there he is, an incredibly powerful man in an incredibly powerful time, and someone who rolled out the red carpet for some of the greatest rulers of that era. Blind History is brought to you by Taylor Blinds and Shutters. All the episodes are available on the cliffcentral.com website and app, as well as Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. He apparently had in his private chapel, he had a crucifix there made of solid gold and a chalice and a paten, which is a dish that they used to put water in. 180 rubies and 9,000 diamonds in it. And he'd pray there every day on his own. So it was just for him.
There was a lot of money in there. It's incredible. CliffCentral.com.